Stephen Asma is a philosophy professor at Columbia College in Chicago. He's also the author of several books, including On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears. He talked to Anne Strangehamps.
Many people know the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia, but I was actually in the Hunterian Museum in London, and they have just jar after jar of these sort of all the ways that nature can go wrong. And this kid is there with his mother. He's having this completely disturbing experience. He's looking at them. He's sort of gasping out loud. And the mother says, you know, should we leave? And he says, absolutely not. You know, he wants to stay and, you know, enjoy.
This is why we have horror movies.
Right, exactly.
So why is it that we enjoy scaring ourselves silly with monsters?
There's a few theories on this, and I look at some of them in the book. I mean, one of the ones that I think a lot of people are familiar with is sort of the Freudian idea that we all have these kind of id-like urges and instincts in us, and there's something about monster stories that allows us a kind of catharsis, and we can let these kind of, you know, let these demons inside us off their chain. They can howl at the moon a little bit, and then we can go on with our lives of quiet repression. So that theory, I think, is well known. But one that I think is more interesting in a way, and kind of something that neuroscience and cognitive scientists are sort of developing, is that there seems to be some arousal and fear kinds of responses when you have cognitive mismatch. So when things don't quite make sense to your cognitive brain, and monsters frequently do this, they're kind of hybrid creatures, mixes of this animal and that animal, then it produces this kind of interesting arousal in us. So there's something that's sort of repugnant and attractive at the same time because there's some disconnect between these parts of the brain.
Mm. Of course, some of the most interesting things you look at about monsters are really what social and cultural functions they've served for us. You know, for instance, if thinking about the world of ancient Greek mythology, you know, in Greek myths, the job description of a hero always seems to be someone who goes off to fight monsters. They're always going off to kill gorgons and hydras and minotaurs. So the monster seems to have functioned in that culture as a kind of test of strength.
I think that's right. And you see sort of two things going on there. One is you see a culture oftentimes demonizing another culture, which is fairly common human behavior. For the ancient Greeks and Romans, they had this view that many species of monsters lived somewhere in India. They had a very strange sense of geography, but you could think about people in foreign places as not just barbaric, but also as subhuman. And then on top of it came this idea that, well, we have warriors who can protect us. So it was an opportunity for manliness to express itself as, you know, we're going to go out there, slay the monsters, and restore security and stability to our community. So that was a common theme in the monster stories.
Hmm. Moving forward, there are monsters in the Bible, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of monsters in the Bible. And it's interesting. If you look at the Bible, you'll find the classic monsters of the Old Testament, something like Behemoth, for example. But then in the book of Revelation, the Apocalypse, you'll find a whole new bevy of dragons and creatures. In addition to this, the patristic, the sort of church fathers, had this whole ancient tradition of monsters. There was a belief in the Cynocephali, for example, which were men who actually went around with dogs' heads. They were like men, but their heads were dogs, and they barked instead of speaking. Then there was also the Blemmii, which were headless creatures, and their mouths and eyes appeared right in the center of their chest. So there's all this great stuff that St. Augustine is trying to sort of analyze and say, well, where does this fit in God's plan? So you see him wringing his hands. Are these humans? Will they be capable of redemption? Should we try to baptize them? So the church and the medieval period was very interested in monsters. Why did God make them? Oftentimes the giants are discussed, and the argument there was the giants must be there to serve a purpose, and the purpose must be God is trying to tell us not to be arrogant and puffed up like the giants because that will make us fall. So this kind of stuff, the morality tales.
Speaking of those dog-headed people or demons, there's a drawing you made in your book of, I think it's a dog-headed saint that was worshipped?
Yeah, that's right. People know St. Christopher from, he basically in the Roman church, he carries Christ across the river and What people don't know is that there's this Eastern Orthodox version of the saint who is, in fact, a member of the kynocephali species, a dog-headed man. And the story there is that he basically comes from this barbaric culture, but he hears the good news. He learns about Christianity and Jesus. He converts, and then he gets the gift of human speech. And then he goes around basically converting people. And the authorities try to kill him right and left, and he becomes this martyr. Yeah, it's a great marriage of the sort of Christian saint tradition and the monster tradition.
Well, an example of taming the beast, I suppose, converting
yeah,
the monster.
Right. Yeah, and it shows you that, see, the monsters, they have potential. They, you know, if, as long as they can be converted, you know, we'll be all right.
But this must have posed a theological dilemma for the early church fathers. If a benevolent God created the world, why on earth would God have created monsters to prey on his creation?
Yeah, it's a great question. Before the Christian view of God, the ancient Greeks, like Aristotle, for example, he thought, well, what happens with a monster is the monster is a combination of form and matter. So the form is perfect, but the matter messes up. And when the form replicates, it makes a monster. So even though you've had this strange offspring, it was supposed to be a human being. And it's just that matter got sort of confused things. But in the Christian paradigm, God makes everything, including matter. So you have this additional problem. Why would God make these evil creatures? What is the point of that? And so it becomes this sort of, you know, the old problem of evil. Why would God allow the monsters to persecute? And when you get to the medieval period, of course, the monsters, they sort of shift from being these natural history monsters in the another part of the world and become the ones we're more familiar with, the demons, the witches, that which possesses us, gets into us like a ghost. And the argument there is the reason why God has created these or allowed these to manipulate people is because human beings, by their immoral activity, deserve this. And that's generally the theological explanation, that you become a witch because your immoral behavior called them down, and this is your own punishment. So that's kind of the argument that's given.
That's fascinating. I hear running underneath everything we've discussed so far the suggestion that the real monsters are us and our works, our creations, and that the monster stories we tell ourselves are complex ways of working out the things that horrify ourselves about ourselves.
I think that's right. If you look at the narratives that we love, even the stuff that people are really into now, vampires, zombies, you do see that the culture is working through some of these fears and anxieties and vulnerabilities that we have. And oftentimes you see that they end with these kind of resolutions that return us to some sense of security. So I do think they're having a kind of social psychological impact.
Hmm. Near the end of your book, you begin to explore human monsters, serial killers, terrorists. Seems as though you're really redefining what exactly a monster is at this point. You know, it's not just a creepy creature or a demon that might possess someone. It can be a friend, a neighbor. Everyone has the potential to become monstrous.
I think that's right. I think it's not so much that I'm redefining it, but the culture has redefined it in this way. It's interesting, when I was working on this book, I punched in one of these Google search terms, and it will return the appearance of, you know, this term anywhere in the news, you know, and you'll get it once a day. And I just typed in, I said, give me back news articles that use the word monster. And every day, the newspapers are filled. And if you haven't sort of noticed this, take a look and you'll see how many times monster is used to describe the criminals in the news that we're sort of experiencing on a daily basis. So this idea of moral monsters is very much with us. And I understand partly what's happening in modern culture is we're coming to understand psychopathology better. At the same time, I think some people run so far afoul of the line that we have no other language by which to sort of characterize them. And so we reach into our bag of terms and concepts, and monster seems to fit. So it's still doing some work, even in the here and now.
I'm curious what you make of the recent spate of movies and books in which it seems as though we're taming or reworking some of our oldest monsters. You know, vampires are becoming simply lovelorn teenagers, and werewolves are the nice adolescent boys next door. Is this kind of an inevitable process, or what's going on?
Yeah, that's interesting. I talk about an older version of this where the monster Grendel gets sort of tamed in the Christian tradition. You know, the old Beowulf story is very much that the monster Grendel is just evil and you have to kill it, and it's just that's the end of the story, full stop. But as you progress along and you get a more liberal culture, I mean small l, tolerant culture, then the monsters get recreated as being not quite as insidious as we thought they were. And, you know, I think about this, you know, your example of the vampires. And if you think about vampires, they're sort of the aristocrat monsters. You know, they're frequently very intelligent. They're good looking. They're sexually attractive. This is also part of the original story, too, if you look at Polidori's vampire. They're almost like you want to be these people. But then again, they live forever and they drink blood, and you know, so it's sort of like it's that attraction repulsion. You're attracted to them, but at the same time, their monster status is an abnegation of their humanity. So it's almost like you can imagine, here's this debonair cad that you're highly attracted to, but watch out, he's going to break your heart. So that's like, that's happening in these stories. I think of zombies as being like the proletariat of monsters because, you know, they're just, they're not attractive. They're not aristocratic. They're just like the workers with a brainstem left, and we're all going to end up like this. And there's something sort of funny going on here. I'm not sure how to get to the bottom of it, but it's definitely communicating something about our culture. And I do think there is a general tendency to want to lend greater humanity to the monsters. That's the story of becoming increasingly liberal. So that's my own take.
Well, my last question, I'm pretty sure I know what you're going to say in answer to it, but do we need monsters?
Oh, yes. I'm sure you knew that was coming. I think we do. Yeah, I don't think they're ever going to go away. As soon as you shine a light in this area, because I basically did a kind of a history of monsters, and that's what happens is you shine a light into an area, and then basically interest in monsters retreats to another area of human endeavor. And it seems to be that that's going to be a constant issue because human beings are, as far as I can tell, are always going to be vulnerable, and that's what monsters are about.
Stephen Asma is the author of On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears. He spoke with Anne Strange Champs.